Your Train is a Thought by Ed Askew. I Can Hardly Speak by Bombay Bicycle Club. Bleachers by Emily Yacina. Rat Boys did Alien with a Sleep Mask On. Everything I Wanted by Billie Eilish. Homage to Vibrating Boundaries by Kyle R. Clyde. Liminal Crisis by Anna Lima. That's a collaboration of Sophie and Juliana Huxtable. And in the background now, that's Reality State by Patio. And you've been listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? I'm Paul Fisher.
I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show, Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV? Or 10 bucks a month? 20, 100, a million? Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
Thank you, Ken Gale. And like the guy claimed, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial radio. Broadcasting at 99.5 FM. What do you know? We're right on time. It's 1 a.m. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning is Charles Baruch. You haven't read him yet? Well, just stay tuned. Good morning. I had a review from Dan Persons of the movie Black Christmas that he actually did about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I misplaced it, and I'm terribly sorry for that. And 2 weeks ago, Dan reviewed and largely panned The Rise of Skywalker, and then last week, Terrence Taylor and I mostly praised very much The Rise of Skywalker, not because we think it's great cinema, great dialogue, great movie, but because we sat in a room for 2.5 hours and had fun. And I understand the criticisms of it, including Dan's, but the bottom line is that I had fun. And the purpose of that show was not to contradict Dan. Dan is, he used to run, or at least be the most important person as far as I'm concerned, at Ciné Fantastique magazine, which those of you who are reading such things like that, you know, when you had things like Starlog and Fangoria and stuff like that, Ciné Fantastique was the cream of the crop. And Dan is a revered movie critic going back at least to the 70s. So I may disagree with him. I disagree often with Manolo Dargis or Tony Scott at the New York Times or even Anthony Lane at the New Yorker. That doesn't mean I disrespect them. And I just want to make clear on the air that absolutely no disrespect was intended. So rock on, Dan. And I hope that you'll have a review for us next week. And I'm sorry that I didn't have Black Christmas, which would have been on 3 weeks ago, but I got preempted. Oh, there's, you know, stuff happens. So, but I did want to just say that to clarify for listeners that last week's show was not put there for the purpose of contradicting Dan. He wouldn't be, you know, the reviewer for Hour of the Wolf, if I thought he was somebody that I would have to fight with, argue with, maybe, but argue, let's say in the Jewish sense of the word, you know, you've heard two Jews, three opinions. Yeah, that is indeed how it works. I don't think Dan is Jewish. No, maybe he is, come to think of it. Doesn't matter. The point is, an argument can be a good thing. Otherwise, all radio would be boring. On the other hand, it would all be Jewish. And that, well, I could go with that. Anyway, let's see. Announcements. Yes, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings features Hildy Silverman and A.C. Wise. So get into your TARDIS and go back to last night. It was great. It was really good. But it is available on Facebook, actually, in the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, in the WBAI radio group on Facebook, and in the, coincidentally, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group. Actually, that's called NYRSF, N-Y-R-S-F, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. It's an easier way to say it. The NYRSF group. And so you can still be there live on recording via TARDIS, etc., etc., and so forth. By the way, part of my purpose last week, I didn't want to just talk about Skywalker. I wanted to talk about Doctor Who. And the first episode of the two-part Doctor Who Spyfall, I really didn't care for. Terrence, my guest last week via Skype, Terrence loved it. I did not. I didn't get the who-ness of it at all. I thought that, you know, you want to talk about fan service. I thought it did that, and very poorly, although Jodie Whittaker does look good in a tuxedo. But the rest of the cast did not. And the plot did not impress me. But then at the very end of that episode, and by that time, of course, I had not seen the second part, which was broadcast this last Saturday on BBC America here and BBC One there, I did like. I think that it made up for the problems that I had with the first episode. But we didn't even get to discuss who last week because Terrence and I were so wrapped up in Star Wars trivia. And this is not supposed to be a show about the media science fiction, although, come on, it's a guilty pleasure. I am so pleased that Who is back with us for however few weeks they deign to have produced episodes. I'm not sure how long this season is. I am very pleased that The Magicians starts next week, which, if you have not watched, well, you owe it to yourself. It's not Lev Grossman's trilogy. It uses that as a starting point and departs by episode number one. It keeps the main characters, and even then, it transposes some of the characters from the novel. But you know what? Read the three novels. They are brilliant. And then, or even intermittently, watch the TV series from episode one. But season five, as they say over where I am, I'm not British, it's season number five, starts like next week, as a matter of fact. And there's a huge spoiler at the end of season four. If you have not seen season four, binge. I'm not a big fan of binging. But you, if you can get into this, and it's really good, you should know what the reveal is. I learned that word from Michael Bishop when I had him once on the show, and we were talking about his baseball-ish novel, science fiction novel. And at about page 80, we learn who the narrator is. And we would not have known that otherwise. And as we were talking, he didn't use the word spoiler. He said, yeah, well, there's a reveal that I would not rather not give to people yet. And I thought, ooh, what a more, you know, spoiler. As John Clute, a critic in science fiction, would say, there's no such thing as a spoiler. But a reveal, aha! I've got you, John. Next time you're on the show, we'll argue that one. But there is a major, major reveal at the end of season four. And unfortunately, the reveal is revealed by, you know, any number of YouTube headers and stupid come on clickbait articles that, you know, like you're not supposed to know that such and such occurred. But in the headline, it will say, so who is really the father of blah, blah, blah's baby? It has nothing to do with the magicians, I promise you. But the point is that if you didn't know that character, you know, was having a relationship, that would be a spoiler. So try, if you can, it's very difficult, try to avoid the spoilers for season four. It's especially difficult now because since the cast is going all over the place on all the TV shows and everything promoting season five, well, they're going to reveal it. And if you would rather be surprised, just watch the damn show. That's it. Let's see. I think that's covered all the reveals of things happening around New York that I would want to mention this week. There is a really cool reading happening tonight, and it includes Sarah Pinsker and somebody with whom I am unfamiliar, all the more reason for me to attend, which I will be. And it is open to the public, but it's a relatively small space. So what you should do is Google Erewhon Books, E-R-E-W-H-O-N, which is a new imprint that Liz Gorinsky is running. And they do a monthly salon. It's more of a salon than a reading, like the KGB readings. I think of them as a salon as well. I think the readings I produce are sort of, you know, proscenium. They're on stage. Don't talk to me. You're audience. You're just audience. But at KGB, it's like you can name everybody in the room. They're all cool writers, editors, big name fans, just really, really cool people. And I think of that like you think of the French salons when you just go into a room like in Paris at Midnight, the Woody Allen movie, and you can name every person in the room. You're just amazed at who the people are. And now there's this new third regular monthly reading series in New York, and they are welcome because we are all sister series. Nobody is going to not attend the reading I produced last night because they're planning on going to see the one tomorrow night at Erewhon Books. It doesn't work that way. You may go to one because you prefer, you know, the writers, the show at one place or another. But we, in fact, all complement each other. And I compliment both the KGB Fantastic Fiction series that Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel run. And I compliment the Erewhon Books reading series, which Liz Gorinsky and I think Martin Cahill, who's now their, I think, publicity director. He's a good guy. Nice, good writer, too, runs. And you can't say the more the merrier. You don't want six or seven in one city. But New York can sustain four, I dare say. So, yeah, I guess we'll take your applications if you want to do one. Bill Shun had one running, but he shut it down. At any rate, if you want to find out about where Sarah Pinsker and Person of Unknown Origin, who I will know by tomorrow night, is reading. Go to Facebook and look up Erwan, E-R-E-W-H-O-N, books, or Google it. Okay. So having given the proper notice to that awful competition I've got, to the wonderful other reading series that are in New York, I think I've finished my announcements. On this program next week, I haven't the slightest idea. We'll figure it out. Probably have a guest. There are quite a few in line who I've been actually waiting for the new year. And one who I know doesn't live in New York is in town next week. So I am hoping that that person will join us. But I'll actually see, I'll give away this much, her at the Erwan Literary Salon. They actually call it a salon. Tomorrow night. Very, very comfortable place there. It's actually in their office. You know, one's in a pub, one's in a cafe with a very large venue, and the other is in this very comfy office where after the reading, they bring out the board games. I mean, come on, that's just cool. You know, they order food and bring out the board games, and people just hang. And that's way cool. So last month at the New York, that's December, we always make the December reading a festive reading. For many years, it was always Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman until those ladies were married to each other. Sort of do additional honeymoons of all type by every year going to Paris for the holidays. And it's like, how can you think of going to Paris when we want you to be reading for that series for one night? You know, it's like, come on. Priorities, Ellen and Delia. Oh, I know they're going to hear this. And I'm going to be in such deep bleep. Let's see. On the list, it's number one. On the Carlin list, that's the number one word. And for those looking on Facebook, we are on Facebook Live. Ooh, I haven't shared it. I need to share it. I need to do that. But I have to face away from the microphone. That doesn't work. It's a directional mic, and I can't turn my head.
You'll have to get me talking, and then...
Well, yeah, I have to get you talking, and I have to turn on your mic. Now your mic...
My microphone might help.
Yeah, well,
pretty loud.
Okay, well, let me give it a try and see. Is this really your microphone? Talk to me again.
I'm talking to you right now. Is this really the microphone?
It is not.
It is not. Would you like me to move to another chair?
No. No, I'd like to find the right mic.
Would you like me to move to several other chairs?
No, the thing I will do is just open up all the microphones and then turn off the one that doesn't sound like you. Do me a favor and just, like, tap the side of the mic for a minute. Ooh, it's none of those. Okay. Ah!
Mike, found me?
I found you.
You found me.
You're mic five.
I'm only sitting, like, 10 feet away. Less.
I've never had a mic five before.
Ah!
I've only had 4K. One. For those who don't know, the way that you number equipment in a studio is that... The engineering position is number one, and then you go clockwise. So that the next mic in that would be number
two, three, four. No, there's two mics there. That's your problem. There's two mics. One is in the position.
Yeah, and they're
it's
actually
a perspective
issue. They're blocked from my vision. No, one of them is totally blocked.
Yep. No,
so that explains it, and therefore you, sir, are mic number five. And last month...
I thought I was Chuck. I'm very confused by you, sir. It's going to be one of those shows.
I'm trying to avoid the puns. You say Chuck, I think steak. You know, and that brings to what's at stake. Let's just stop it right there. Yes. Having said that, I was not very familiar with the work of Charles, a.k.a. Chuck Baruch, until last month when Randy Dawn, editor with Michael A. Van Trilla, and publisher Ian Randall Strock brought out their Across the Universe book, the second book in 2019, a little higher. Thank you for those watching on the radio. You can see the cover of the book. The second collection of Beatles short stories of science fiction to come out last year. I wonder how many people. Did you know that?
Yes.
Oh, very good.
I was talking to young Mr. Ryan yesterday.
Ah, very, yes, yes, very good. He had read, I encountered him because Keith DeCandido, some years ago, was supposed to be a reader at one of the New York readings and somehow managed to not make it for the second act that he was supposed to be at. So I looked out at the audience and I said, "So, who wants to read?" And Jim Ryan got up.
Yeah.
And he read this wonderful story, which I then had him come back and read on the air, in which it ties in to Doctor Who, in which the Beatles never happened. That's the standard.
Mm-hmm.
And Ringo, or rather Richard.
Yes, Richard Starkey.
Richard Starkey, who did change his name to Richard Starr.
Yep.
For purposes of his TV work, because he became a companion on Doctor Who in like the second or third season.
Yep.
And the story takes place, modern time, at a Doctor Who convention where Richard Starr is talking about his experience on Doctor Who and is telling the trivia stories of the band that he was in that failed. I mean, it's clever stuff. Most of the stories in Across the Universe are very clever, which is, you know, that's just like...
I'd venture to say all of them were very clever.
I think so. I think so. It's a lot of fun. It's a good thing. So anyway, it was there that I heard Charles Baruch read his work and there that I met him. And I think it was even right on the spot that I offered you a date to come on this program.
You threatened to twist my arm if I wasn't willing to. It was very forceful.
The date was uncertain because I didn't, you know, we said January 8th.
Yep.
But, you know, you see, you know, you were thinking that it was going to be last night, but I had always said January 8th. Yep. Oh, that's Wednesday.
Yep.
And now it's in New York, it's Thursday.
Yes, it is.
But probably...
Time works that way when you don't have a TARDIS.
And yes, and yet, and yet...
And yet.
We have a great many listeners, many hundreds, for whom it is still Wednesday.
Yep.
Or, it is even weirder, it is tomorrow. Yes. No, it's today, but it's late morning. As opposed to very early morning. So...
A lot of wibbly-wobbly stuff in there.
Yeah. Exactly. Just listen to the radio and don't blink. that should basically cover it all.
Yes.
And so, Chuck, tell us a little bit about yourself for our files. Oh, my God, you got that reference?
The Mrs. Robinson reference? Yes.
No, no. Oh, yeah, yes. No, it is.
Yep.
I was thinking of an even
reference?
More. I thought I was quoting a different song than the one I was quoting.
Simon and Garfunkel is with you there.
Yeah, no, this one was a Tom Paxton song. Good
that
morning.
That I might have missed.
Yeah. called Good Morning, Mr. Blue. We've got our eyes on you.
Yeah.
It's a very dark song, and even though it is 50 years old, it is frighteningly appropriate today.
Yeah. So, I don't like to be bored. As a result, I almost always hold multiple jobs at the same time, so I've got about 80 years on my resume, and I've worked in a lot of different industries, and that's given me the opportunity to be very broad in the kind of writing that I do. Because I don't come from one perspective. I come from a lot of different perspectives. I work with people at different economic levels, from people from different countries, people who are involved in completely different perspectives, people who are affected differently by different world events. And that's one of the things that I try to bring forward in the writing that I do. I also do work as a journalist, which has had a lot of impact on that as well. So right now, let's see. There is a day job, which is split between two companies. There's the consulting business. There's the editing for International Spectrum, which is a small technology magazine out of Colorado. There's the writing. There's the editing on the fiction side. And hopefully soon game design, which is something I've been putting off for way too long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you said that thing about
board games. Electronic game design or board
games? Traditional board games.
Oh, cool.
Yep. I actually do a lot of work in the computer area.
Do you know Carlos Hernandez, wonderful writer?
I do not.
Oh, you must meet.
Ah.
You must meet. He's not only a wonderful science fiction writer who started as a small press writer. The title of his book. The Cuban American Guide to Quantum. I'm going to have to look it up and say it. I'm embarrassed. Oh. And since then, with these brilliant short stories he's written, all of a sudden he decided to do something stupid and become a big-name mid-list writer, well, middle-grade writer for Disney's imprints. Sal and Gabby Save the Universe. That title I can remember.
There you go.
And, you know, he opens books of wonder and stuff. But
So, Carlos, apparently we need to meet, and I'll be here for the next 2 hours if you want to swing by, or you can catch me in a story at the board game group.
Well, I actually, he lives not that far from you.
Yeah, come on down.
He and do you know of Claire Cooney, CSE Cooney?
No, I do not.
Won the World Fantasy Award 2 years ago for Bone Swans. They're married.
Yep.
So, and both a wonderful couple. And had we not been taken off the air in October, they would have been my guests on Halloween night. I'm really annoyed at missing Halloween night.
Yeah.
At any rate, he works when he's not writing, when he's not teaching at CUNY, the Queens College.
Yep.
He is not CUNY, CCNY, as opposed to City University, which is, I think, just the one college in Harlem. But he's at CCNY, at Queens College. He designs board games for a living.
Ah.
He has several out there.
I almost did that for a living.
Mm-hmm.
I had I used to go to Toy Fair every year.
Okay.
And
I went once.
I went this 1 year, and I'm showing games. I went the next year, I'm showing games. I come this 1 year, and apparently there had been some sort of a nonsense lawsuit, and everybody was afraid to look at a game anymore. It was one of these, I had a game with dice, you published a game with dice, obviously you stole from me kind of lawsuits. And so I ran into the problem that they would be happy to talk to me, but nobody would look at anything. I ran into this one guy at Ideal named Marvin Silbermans. And Marvin's like, stop talking, pull out a game, let's play something. Really? Really, yeah. So Marvin and I sit down and play some of my games, and he's giving me spot reviews on it. You know, if people were moving out from the center instead of in toward the center, people would like the game better. And if we were to produce it at Ideal, we'd put a Pop-matic in the center, which is another reason to bring people out. And he introduces me to Sid Saxon. He introduces me to Darwin and Lauren Bromley, who were running Mayfair Games at the time. It just, I'm like family all of a sudden. I'd met the man that moment. We're having these great conversations. A few weeks later, I get a phone call.
Speaking of family, Joanna says hi.
Oh, hi. And I get this phone call, and it's like, I'm interested. Which of my games? No, I'm interested in you. There's an opportunity to be the assistant creative manager of games at Ideal Toys. The only person who's up for the job right now is internal, and they want it because it's a promotion. They don't care about what I do. You care about what I do. I want you to come in. So he coaches me about the job and how to approach his boss, and he brings me in, and I sit down with Carl Eisenberg, and Carl hires me on the spot. And I say the stupidest thing I could have said, and if I could go back, I would have changed it. I said I need to give 4 weeks' notice. What I meant was I needed to give 2 weeks' notice to the 82 hours a week that I was doing as a fast food manager for Wendy's, and I wanted 2 weeks to wash the hamburger grease off of me,
right.
Spend a little time with my wife and my infant daughter and become a little bit human before I started commuting from Flushing to Secaucus, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
The Friday before I'm supposed to start, I get a phone call. Carl's been fired. There is no budget line for the job you were hired for. It doesn't actually exist.
Ooh.
And I suddenly no longer had my fast food job, which was gone for 4 weeks, and I was not going back, and did not have the job with Ideal.
That borders on breach of contract.
Oh, it does. But here's the weird piece in the story. 12 years later, I'm on an airplane coming back from Florida. There's a problem with the rental car. I get there at the last minute. I get into the different seat than I was originally assigned. I'm chatting with the guy next to me, and lo and behold, I said to him, I almost worked for Ideal. He said, I never knew your name, but I know the story. I said, what? He says, you're talking about Marvin and Carl, right? I didn't give him the names. He gave them to me. I said, yeah. He said, Carl knew he was going to be fired. I said, what? He said, he figured if he hired you, Marvin would get popped up to his job and you would have been the creative manager at Ideal Toys your second week on the job. That's the bet I didn't know I was making.
Wow.
Okay. That's, like I was telling you before, that's my favorite Small World story. And I've had tons of them. There's a lot of weird things that happen out there. I find that as problem as a fiction writer is the amount of things that I discover are weirder in the real world. You know the famous quote, the difference is fiction has to make sense?
Right.
I've seen some truly, truly bizarre things. And that's part of what makes me a writer. It's part of what makes it there because I figured out a long time ago, I like to talk, I like to tell stories, but people only want to listen if they're interesting. So I made a tremendous effort to learn a lot, to discover a lot of things. And if I was going to credit anything for everything that I do, it really comes down to that and a couple of really opportune circumstances. And my first gig as a writer was because I ran the role play club at Queens College.
Oh, really?
And the guy who took over the club for me was a guy named Jeff Gomez, I had mentioned to you earlier.
I'm wondering if you don't know Carlos, but don't know that you know him.
It is possible. We may have people in common. We very much may have people in common. So,
ooh.
Yep.
The Cuban-American's Guide to Quantum Santeria. That's the name of his collection of short stories. Sorry.
Very cool.
Just came to me at an inappropriate moment.
A lot of things happen at inappropriate moments.
Well, that's the... Yeah.
In any event. So I left. Jeff took over. Jeff left. Laura Antonou took over. And then one day Laura calls Jeff and says, we've been producing this little Xeroxed Rexode magazine thing, and we've been putting it on the shelf in Complete Strategist, and people are picking it up. We don't know how to turn this into a real magazine. Maybe you want to come play.
Hmm.
So Jeff comes back to publish. Laura's the editor. And the same way Laura reached back to Jeff, Jeff reaches back to me and says, you want to come write for us? And I can trace every writing and teaching gig I have had back to that, because I used that as my proof. I had the opportunity to do some technical articles. Well, how do I know you can write? Here's my articles and gateways. Okay, so now you've got these articles and these articles. Well, can you teach? Well, yeah, if I can talk this way, I can talk this way. And I kind of draw that line, and it's funny, when you saw me for the first time was December 3rd. December 1st, we did a reunion. I got to see some people I had not seen since college, including Laura and Jeff at the same time. I talked to Jeff a lot, but I'd seen him maybe twice other than that. And the three of us being in the same room was a very sentimental moment for me. And I'm glad that I was able to bring that forward into here. So, you know, there's a lot of these kind of things, these kind of connections that give you an opportunity to do things. And they've given me an opportunity to do a lot of writing. For example, and I'll hold it up for the camera, Canyons of the Damned, issue number 34. Mm-hmm. I got into that because I went to my friend John Frater's birthday party, and Daniel Arthur Smith, who had just published Laura Frater, John's wife, had just published one of Laura's stories, started complaining to me, I don't get the out-of-the-box stories I really want. I get too many conventional stories. I said, I've got a story about somebody who flings their friends into the sun because you can't bury people in the asteroid belt. He said, I'm in. And that's how I got into Canyons of the Damned. And a lot of it is really that. It's I've found people, I've gotten into the right conversation, I've had the right opportunity, and I've got this backlog of stories and the willingness to write new things on spec. And that's given the opportunity to write in a lot of different genres and a lot of different approaches. So if you were, for example, to find me in Nova Pulp, which is another anthology series that I was in, I got into there because when I started my anthology series, the folks over at Hermit Tree Press said, "We really like your contract. Can we steal it and make it our contract?" So they took my writer's contract and they said, "You know, we actually kind of like your stories. Can you edit for us?" I was like, "Well, if I'm editing for you, can I write for you?" And the first story, I think they took on charity because it was not really a good fit for what they did. The second story, which was in this one, is one of my personal favorites. And it came from a conversation that one of the editors in their group had had. She had just lost a bunch of weight, and she'd posted a picture of herself. And she wasn't posting it because she'd lost the weight. It was just a picture of herself. And this one person said, "Oh, my God, you've lost so much weight. Tell me what you did. Literally tell me whatever you tell me, I'll do it." And she wrote up this post on Google Plus, because that's where we were at the time, about the shock of the responsibility.
You say Google Plus, you have to doff your hat.
I'm sorry.
Even if it's radio, because
Google Plus.
I liked Google Plus.
I liked Google Plus a lot also. I did 5 anthologies with writers that I met on Google Plus.
Wow.
Those are the ones I published, not counting the other ones that I was in, that I got connected to people because of it. But the key thing in all this is that those kind of connections, that reaching out, I mean, people always talk about writing as a solo profession, as a thing people do in a dark room by themselves. I'll go to a food court and sit and write. I am fascinated by the idea of being in the world without having any responsibility for the people around me. So that life is going on while I'm writing. To be connected to things is a big part of why I do what I do. And that's why I started doing multi-author anthologies. That's why I started editing for other people. That's why I've connected through all these different methods that I've connected.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the fun things about that is my brother got an echo off of this. So the technology magazine that I'm now editing, that I used to write for and still write for,
which is called?
International Spectrum. And we cover a NoSQL environment called Multivalue.
Okay. You probably have to explain to most of the listeners what the whole SQ deal is.
So most people, when they say database, say SQL, and they think those things are interchangeable. And SQL is actually not a database. It's a way to query a database. It's
right.
How to ask questions.
Yeah. It's a language.
Right.
Or a format.
Right. Exactly. And the thing people get confused is this all becomes compacted because it's not their day job and they don't live with these things. And we shorthand the stuff we don't have to pay attention to. You know, we don't really pay attention to the difference between a sous chef and a expediting chef and a master chef because we're not working in the kitchen. When you work in the kitchen, you see those differences. When I deal with these environments, this is where I live. I deal with data architecture. I deal with web design, you know, with full stack development, with segmented development, with all the different ways you approach this stuff. So for me and the kind of people that follow me in that magazine, they're living, eating, sleeping, and breathing whether SQL is the right choice for them, whether they need alternatives to it, and Multivalue is a long-legged alternative, one that's lasted a very long time. And so there was a point I was getting to somewhere in there. Oh, so story about my brother. So the same way that my having founded the D&D Club echoed into my writing in the magazine echoed into all these other things. When my brother was a little bit, and I won't say unemployed, he was underemployed. He was working, just not up to where he wanted to be. I said to him, "You got some time. Come write for me at the magazine." And he wrote a couple of articles for us. And then he got approached bolt out of the blue by eBay. And I'd like to say it was because of the magazine, and it wasn't. They had no idea who was writing for us. But during the interview process, they started talking to me, "Well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that?" My brother said, "Here's a stack of magazines. Here's what I think about it. Here's the articles I've published that I've gone on record. This is how I think." And the guy comes back to my brother Bennett, and he says, "Listen, all his articles, I didn't read any of them. But my wife read all of them, and she says I have to hire you." And that's how he ended up at eBay. So we were not the only reason. The fact that he has code in the Smithsonian Institution, the fact that he's been involved in major projects across a wide range of companies had a little bit to do with it. But we got him a little bit of that push toward the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice that the way that writing in magazines had gotten me all these pushes that I was able to kind of pay that forward and give that story to somebody else.
When did you start writing fiction?
Well, that was the problem. Because I was always telling – no. I was always telling people I was a fiction writer, but – I had written for Database Trends. I got two articles in eWeek. I did an article in Business Week.
Which doesn't writing. Mean you're not writing right. fiction. I'm sorry.
Okay, so I was doing all this technical writing. I was doing all this article writing.
I gave up on eWeek when it was no longer PC Week.
Yeah.
And I'm a fan of the first Spencer Cat. Spencer the Cat.
Yeah.
And I know who it was, but...
There you go. I've seen the costume, but not populated.
Oh, no. I would never out David Dejean as being...
very conscientious of you.
It's 20 years now. I think the truth can be told.
Yep.
And I haven't heard from David. He was a wonderful...
You might now.
He joined the Peace Corps and went to Africa after he stopped being Spencer the Cat.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a close friend of my partner, Barbara's. They work together. I was his editor for all of two articles. You know, this is a guy who, is one of the top editors and writers in technology journals in the 90s when this stuff really mattered, when it was forming. Now we're dealing with the fallout. Then we were in the building process.
Yep.
And David was the person with his ear to the ground who – it was sort of like a gossip column for the technology industry, for those who don't know who Spencer the Cat was.
Yes.
And David Dejean was, I think, half of it. There was another person whose name – no, doesn't escape me, but who I won't out. I was good friends with David, so I will out him.
Right.
And after he went to Africa, we've been in touch like once every few years, but I don't go to tech events anymore, and he doesn't, so we're not as in touch. But a wonderful human being, and I hope that the fact that I say this somehow gets back to him.
That would be a lovely thing.
But.
So back to your question.
Yes.
So I'm writing for all these different magazines. I'm doing the work for Gateways, which is where I was writing, where Laura Antoniou is my editor, where Jeff is my publisher. And I'm telling everyone I'm a fiction writer, but I'm just not doing that. So in 2002, I said, okay, I've got these two trunk novels. Trunk novels, for people who don't know, are novels that should stay in the trunk.
Well, not should.
Really shouldn't in these cases.
The phrase comes from trunk songs. And it comes from people like Cole Porter and Frank Lesser and people like that who wrote more songs than they had shows on stage.
Yeah.
And so very often they wrote songs that could not fit into a show. Irving Berlin also.
Yep.
And Gershwin. And the plots of the shows never mattered. They'd go into the trunk and they'd pull out the songs and they'd build a show around that.
Right.
That's where the terminology trunk blank comes from trunk songs. And trunk stories starts 30 years after
that I
trunk
did not
songs.
Know. Yeah. I have learned a thing. In any event, when I say trunk novels, I mean they should stay in the trunk.
Okay.
So I had these two trunk novels.
And very often people feel that way, but often trunk novels and trunk stories are perfectly good stories that simply got rejected. Then the writer becomes known, or it's 20 years later and they send them out again. And
a different series
of editors say, oh, I like this. This is timely.
Yeah. So I said, it's time for me to actually produce something that should see the light of day. And so in 2002, I started writing Adjacent Fields. And in 2012, I finished writing Adjacent Fields, having spent 11 years not writing, because I kept looking at it and going, I've got 4 million characters, I've got 57 different subplots going on. I can't write another word until I sit down and re-review the material.
It sounds like an episode of Lost.
Great excuse for 11 years. What?
I said, that sounds like an episode of Lost.
Yes. And I just... didn't until I finally did. And once I got Adjacent Fields put together, I finally figured out that I can write and that I want to write and that my stories were good enough to start putting them out there. And once I did that, I started getting a lot of other material out there. I got the five Tiago novels out that are out right now.
Okay, that's T-I-A-G-O.
Yes.
And you'll have to explain.
Okay, so.
Because I know there's the third person from the left listening right now doesn't know what that is.
So the story is that at the time I was married and my wife was going through chemo. And it was rough. It was breathtakingly rough. And she was starting to give up. And we met through science fiction. We met because we were both in the fandom. And I said to her, I'm going to write something for you. And I'm going to just keep producing stuff for you. And you're going to stay alive so you can go read. And I put together the novels based on that originally. Just literally, she was the audience, and anybody else who wanted to read them, that was fine too.
That was her prerogative,
but
yeah.
I put together these five novels, four novellas in a novel, technically. And the idea was I took a character who is a perfect rogue, and he has done this wonderful, terrible thing. He has stolen this massive spaceship from an evil government. So his one truly good act was theft. Okay? On the back cover, I wrote, programmer, subversive, thief. Those three words describe Tiago. And I put together the first story, Tiago the Masterless, in which he says, I am Tiago Breno Davi Salazar, and I am your master. It's worth a shot. Okay? And Tiago is this great, big, larger-than-life type character who's bumbling and stumbling through things, largely because the outcome of stealing the spaceship is he has now spent 608 days in isolation with no human contact and has gone completely mad before the story opens.
Okay.
Okay? So I took a character who's making friends. Literally, he's building bodies for the AI on the ship, so he's got somebody to talk to. So, of course, the first body he builds is based on the girl he lost.
Of course.
And four books in, you find out that's not exactly true. Body is based a lot more on him than on her, because the only person he's ever truly loved, of course, is himself. And a lot of what it was this continuous series of reveals. I would set something up, and then in the next book you'd understand why that was how Tiago chose to tell you the story, but not what's really going on, or how he now believes it, having gone through what he's gone through, but it's not what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these joyous romp stories where everybody on the crew has attempted to kill him at one time or another. It's almost a rite of passage to get on the ship, is to attempt to assault the captain. And so I started with Tiago the Masterless. I did Tiago versus the Jesuani, which is this group of aliens that's constantly chasing him. I brought him into Tiago in the Tunnels of Crawl. Tiago faces the Abyss. And then the last one, Tiago the Pawn, where his past quite literally catches up with him in the truest possible way.
Okay.
Okay? There's another 15 books planned, but a number of things, including the fact that she stopped reading in the middle of the third book, kind of blunted the impact of going further with the series.
Now, are these all in print?
They are all in ebook print, so they're
okay.
They're in e-ink. They are all in print. They're all available. They're all on Amazon. They're all on Kobo. They're all on Barnes & Noble's website.
Anywhere where non-books are sold.
Yes, there you go. Exactly, exactly. So I did those. I started doing anthologies because I was starting to self-publish, and I did not want to be a self-publisher. I wanted to be a small press.
Now, when you say you were doing anthologies, do you mean you were editing or you were contributing?
I was editing multi-author anthologies.
Okay.
And doing the layout and soliciting the covers, doing literally the full publishing job. And the interesting thing we did is I used to teach a critiquing circle. I used to teach a writing class back in the late 80s when most people didn't know what the words online and chat room meant on Q-Link, Quantum Computer Services.
Oh, God, yes, yes, yes.
At $3.60 an hour up to $4.80 an hour at one point at dial-up speeds, people were taking my writing classes.
Well, if you're just typing in ASCII characters, plain old typewriter characters with no graphics, dial-up speeds are sufficient.
Oh, no. There was graphics, too, and there was fairly sophisticated message boarding, and there was live classrooms. It was actually a quite a setup.
You see,
it was all private network.
I started, I think, at 1,200 baud, and that was slow. But when it went to 2,400 baud, it was perfect because as messages came through to me at 2,400, I could read them as they scrolled across. It was my people say, "What's your reading speed?"
Yep.
I don't know how
2,400 baud.
Exactly. I don't know how many words per minute. And then it went to 9,600, and it's like no. No, scale back. It's bursting on the screen. You're giving me paragraphs at a time. I can't read that fast. Conversation is going on, and I have to scroll up to see what was already said. Go back to 2,400 baud. You know, nowadays, people are battling for 200 megabits.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I have 100 megabits at home. And for streaming and this and that and the other thing, 'tis quite sufficient.
Yeah.
But they still try to sell you 200 megabits.
So when I was on Q-Link and I was teaching.
But for Q-Link, 2,400 baud would have been okay.
Maybe yes, maybe no.
You can always get a cup of coffee.
Your mileage may vary. I can always get a cup of coffee.
Yes.
Any time of the day or night, as many cups as you got.
And you can still sleep after.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm the same. I can drink a lot of coffee.
I've actually had two sleep studies done. What I do does not class as sleep. It does not qualify.
You and Gary Null, we were talking about him off the air.
He
doesn't quite sleep either.
The sleep researcher shows me an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, turned sideways like this, bunch of sawtooths on it, says the peak of every one of these is when you stopped breathing. I said, that many in a night? He said, this is a minute and a half, Mr. Barish.
Whoa.
Yeah. He said, what you do doesn't qualify as sleep. We're not sure you actually entered REM state at any point during either of the two sleep studies. So I believe the statistic is if you go more than 72 hours without sleeping, you're clinically insane.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got fairly good evidence I may have actually never slept.
See, when I asked, if you use Android, I meant the phone, not RU.
So the roundabout where we started this was that when I decided to do the anthologies, I set them up as cross critiques. So in addition to formal editing going on, every writer got to have an opinion of every other writer's stories in those anthologies.
Hmm. Okay.
And when I submitted my stories to the anthologies, I told every writer they had the right to blackball the story if it wasn't strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
And in the five anthologies we did, I believe we only ever blackballed one story. And it broke my heart. It was in the first one. Michelle handed me the story, and I looked at it and said, I can't include this. It's not at the right quality level. And she said, that's okay. I've got something else. And she handed me something that was breathtakingly brilliant, and it made it in. And I was over the moon thrilled with it. She did some very good work in a bunch of the anthologies. But it was the funniest thing. It literally went from, hey, kids, it was the old Judy Garland bit. I got a barn. My mom can make costumes. Let's put on a show.
You're leaving out Mickey.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, I left out Mickey Rooney. I apologize. He's small. I missed him.
Actually, that's – is it – yeah, it is.
Come on,
the one in the barn.
Life is short, and so am I.
Yeah, right.
Let's be fair.
But the one that's actually in the barn is Gene Kelly and Judy.
It's not me.
It's Summerstock.
I am sorry. Yep.
I mean, it's usually otherwise, hey, there's that theater down the block that isn't being used. That's Mickey and Judy.
Yep.
When it's a barn and everybody just get together so we stay on camera, that's Gene Kelly.
Yes.
So and sometimes Rita Hayworth.
We literally went in 6 months from, hey, kids, let's put on a show, to done, edited, cross-critiqued, professionally handled, fully laid out, ebooks down and available, and we started pushing out anthologies like that, and that worked out really nicely. We got five of those done. They're called Themethology. They're available the same places where non-books are sold, to use your line. We did one called Invasion. We did one called The Day I Died, where every main character is either dead at the beginning of the story or within 24 hours of dead at the beginning of the story. And I did a story in there where you have two characters who are constantly reincarnated and have figured out that if they can be careful about when they die, one can always tell the other one where we buried stuff, where we kept stuff. They can actually live very, very well. Except the story starts when one of them has actually gone clinically insane, and you're now realizing you're going to be reincarnated for all of eternity with a crazy person. Then we did one called New Myths, and there were some great stories in there. I have to call out one specifically.
I like that title.
Alicia Escobar did a story about the Greek gods and all these other pantheons and how they were trying to find worship in a world that had given up on gods but believed in celebrities.
Uh-oh.
And she did a beautiful story called The Black Daggers. And it was the only story she wrote for me, and I really wish she had done more. It was just breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of things like that. We had this one guy, Martin Sparnow. His sister had written a bunch of stuff for us. He wrote exactly one story. It was great. Never wrote another one. He had the one story in him. We got it. It was lovely. Then after that, we did Real World Unreal. And then the last one that we did was called Mad Science. And my friend Deb Fedgen did this gorgeous, moody, majestic picture of, I forget which college it is, but it's a tower from one college. And it was the perfect mad scientist lair, and we used that as the cover. We altered it from there to give it a little more depth to it. As an inside joke, we actually found a picture of the very first plastic surgeon who had ever worked. He was a battlefield surgeon who was doing repair on soldiers. We found a picture of him and inset it into the window so it looked like he was working inside the building. And it was beautiful. And one of these days I would love to go back and do that again. I miss doing the anthologies because the cross-critiquing had the wonderful energy to it.
Well, you can join a writer's group and get critiques.
I was at my writer's group earlier tonight.
Oh, okay.
And so I was working with...
Which group is that?
It's a group we do online. There's only about seven or eight of us.
Oh, it's an online group.
Yeah, an online group.
Okay. Yeah, the groups I know are in person.
Yeah. No,
and there's a very good one in Brooklyn.
Ah. I may have to hit you up on that later.
I will tell you off the air, yes.
We can absolutely do that. And so what I'm doing this year for 2020 is this is my year of collaboration. And that's how I'm going to recapture that energy.
Okay.
I plan on getting 15 stories, some of them novel length, some of them shorter, 15 stories out in 2020.
Okay.
I've lined up 11 collaborators so far, and I might be able to hit 13 because I've got two people I'm talking to right now.
Mm-hmm.
And six of the projects are already in progress.
Whoa.
So I'm doing a story with Gordon Lindsner.
Okay.
Which is about what happens when man has lost Earth to seven alien races and one slave thinks he's figured out how to get it back for us.
Okay.
So we're working on that right now. We're about six
Let
chapters
me guess,
in.
Stardicus?
No. It's called Sounds Familiar.
I was thinking, yes. Stardicus. I am Stardicus. It could work.
Well, maybe you and I will co-author that one. I got slots.
I'll send it to Kirk Douglas.
I don't think he's doing a lot of writing right now.
I wonder about that. He's pretty active. He just, his mouth and motor facilities aren't fully there. But you read interviews with him, and he's still there. Michael Douglas can make a movie and bring him in.
Yeah.
They've done it. So.
So on the other side of that, I'm actually co-authoring something with a friend of mine I've known since junior high school who has never actually written a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working with people like Gordon. I'm working with people like Ann Stolinsky, Keith, who you mentioned before. I just got a yes out of him yesterday.
Keith DeCandido.
Yes, thank you. I can't do his last name right. And as somebody with a difficult last name, I feel terrible about that. And I really need to do that better. I'm doing a lot of work with a lot of different people, and my goal, like I said, is to get 15 new pieces of writing out there this year so that I can get that wonderful energy from collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's why I do this. Like I said, I'm not that guy who sits in a room alone in the dark and writes as he goes into an alcoholic stupor. I'm that guy who writes to connect to the world. I want to be part of all of this. That's why I was thrilled when you invited me on here. Because you give me a chance to talk, I'll keep going.
Yeah. Although being 2 a.m. over WBAI New York, wasn't that clever to do the station break right in?
Perfect segue.
It is. What we should do is listen to you read some of your fiction.
Oh, we can absolutely do
but
that.
But before we do that, why don't we play a song?
We can
Let's
do that
take
too.
A break. And because I mentioned the song earlier and I haven't played it in years.
Go for it.
I figured we'd revisit Tom Paxton. And we will be back in but a couple of minutes. Now, okay, let's see. New console. Which one of these is
button,
going
button,
to...
Who's got the button?
Which one? But no, I know.
I figured we'd revisit compact.
I found it. And it was me in 7-second delay.
Which is a bad thing. So I have to go... Oh, dear.
Okay,
What did you do? What did you do?
What I did was I turned up the console,
yep.
which goes into the computer here, the computer there, which also has Facebook on it, is broadcasting the show on Facebook, which is several seconds behind.
Should you and I just whistle the song you had in mind?
Yeah, well that it would be very interesting. We were talking about Shickley's music before.
Yep.
But what I have to do is I have to find where there's so many people running so many browsers. Oh, there we are.
Yeah, we are.
Because I saw you for a second. And all I have to do now is
mute that site, which is now probably done. Now I can bring the pot, which, by the way, is short for potentiometer, up. And I think even though they're sliders, they're still potentiometers. But, you know, potentiometers are, you know,
we,
in the
we
old
could
radio
rip
consoles.
Open the console and check if you want.
Yeah, yeah.
I got a screwdriver with me. Army knife.
You have vodka and orange juice.
I had that earlier.
That's one. Okay, fine. Yeah. Yes, well, I want the Fernet Branca root. But at any rate, and we all know how painful that can be, at any rate, okay, now where the hell did I put the Paxton song? Ooh, why is this open?
People come in here, they use the computer, they don't log out.
This is why I never use computers. I don't use any form of technology. I just, none of it's
you
ready
for
prime.
You got a laptop right over there.
None of it's ready for prime time. Coal on the back of shovels. That's as technical as I get. I don't use anything newer than coal on the back of shovels.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got so much stuff open. Okay. Yeah. There's Facebook.
If you That's need fine. To vamp, I can start telling people about the fact that I used to work for the company that made this tie.
Ah, there you go. But
yeah.
Except that the vast majority of people.
Well, they can imagine the tie. Do you remember the old Stan Freberg Pittsburgh commercial Painting Lake Michigan? Where he describes the entire experience?
That's a riff on an earlier bit that he did on one of his radio shows.
Yeah.
And the expert on that, Max Schmid, should be here, but he isn't. Probably because the room that he works in is taken away. But Max does the Golden Age of Radio for WBAI. He is the keeper of all things. Let's see if you know this name, Gene Shepherd.
Not one of them.
Okay. Yeah, well, you have a treat ahead of you to learn all about Gene Shepherd.
Yeah.
But he plays and all that. But he and I are both huge Stan Freberg fans.
Yep.
But Gene Shepherd, most Americans know of Gene Shepherd as the author and from his radio show, the inspiration for the movie, what is the title? Is it A Christmas Story? Little Ralphie?
That was him?
That's Gene Shepherd.
Put your eye out.
Red Ryder Rifle, that's Gene Shepherd. Those are radio shows. He went on the air, he told these quasi-fictional stories of his childhood.
Yep.
He was doing this from, I think, the 50s through the 80s.
That's interesting, because I also had a fictional childhood.
And all that, he has a number of books out and all that. He is one of the founders of Freeform Radio. And he's not around with us anymore.
Yeah.
Max is the keeper of the flame here on WBAI. And also he does a podcast, all Gene Shepherd all the time. And, yeah, Gene Shepherd is one of the great creators of radio. And almost everybody knows a lot of his work, whether it's from that overplayed movie.
Yep.
In which the people, you know, who watch that movie, They don't know who the hell Gene Shepard is. They just think this thing is out of nowhere. He plays Santa Claus in that movie, by the way.
Ah.
He gets his little cameo, and he is the narrator of the movie.
And he gets to kick the little boy.
And he gets to kick the little boy, which is supposed to be himself.
Yes.
It was Peter Billingsley, but it was supposed to be little Gene
Shepard.
There are a
lot of people in this world that would like to kick their younger selves for one reason or another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter Billingsley is supposed to be okay, though.
Yeah.
He's still producing stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, including, you know, touring productions, stage mm-hmm. productions Very of cool. Christmas Story. At any rate, all that aside.
You were going to play some music.
Yeah, let's. So, good morning, Mr. Blue.
Good morning, Mr. Blue. We've got our eyes on you. The evidence is clear that you've been scheming. You'd like to steal away and while away the day. You'd like to spend an hour dreaming. What will it take to whip you into line? A broken heart, a broken head. It can be your ring, it can be your ring. Step softly, Mr. Blue. We know what's best for you, and we know where your precious dreams will take you. You've got a slot to fill, and fill that slot you will. You'll learn to love it, or we'll break you. What will it take to whip you into line? A broken heart, a broken head. It can be your rain, it can be your rain. Be careful, Mr. Blue. This phase you're going through can lead you nowhere else but to disaster. Excuse us while we grin. You've won our patience then. It's time we showed you who's your master. Don't worry, Mr. Blue. We'll take good care of you. Just think of it as sense and not surrender. But never think again that you can think again, or you'll get something you'll remember. What will it take to whip you into line? A broken heart, a broken head. It can be your rain, it can be your rain.
Ooh. It is so long since I've heard that song. Why is it that given that I'm using a digital legal source to play that, do I hear the scratching of vinyl in the background?
What's wrong with the scratching of vinyl?
Well, in digital, it's a rare thing. And, oops, Mike, 5-year. Yes, yep, not four. No. There you go.
Mike, 5-year? Was that a Yoda moment there? Mike,
yes.
5-year. Yes.
When I don't try,
yep.
I can do certain imitations fairly well. When I don't try. When I try, they suck. So, but every so often I can say something in a voice and I nail it. And then if I try to do it, forget it.
I will say to you what I said to my kids. You need to know where your limitations are so you know where to push against.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know what story you are going to read.
No,
so
you don't.
I usually try to, after a story, I usually play a song.
Yeah.
So we're going to do it free form. You're going to read. I'm going to choose a song.
Ah. So you mentioned the name Adler many, many times as we were talking.
The woman, she who created this radio show.
Yes.
Margot Adler.
So I was originally going to read from Ship of the Dead, the story that I did in Canyons of the Damned.
Mm-hmm.
But I recently heard the audiobook, and I don't want to compete with that. Daniel picked a really good narrator, and he did a beautiful job. And so I was trying to figure out what to do next. And given what you'd mentioned, I had this story sitting here. It hasn't been published yet, about a psychiatrist. And it just seemed wildly appropriate.
And so, for those who don't know of Margot Adler's background, her grandfather was Alfred Adler, as in Freud, Adler, and Jung. Many, many years ago, we had a guy working here named Bill Jung, Y-O-U-N-G.
Yeah.
And so I arranged the mailboxes. We had these huge mailboxes so that they were Freund, Adler, and Jung.
There you go. They were a great comedy team. I saw them in vaudeville.
I got my kicks when it took them about 2 months to realize that I had created Freund, Adler, and Jung.
Yep.
And it was like, hey. But at least she was legitimate.
Yep.
She's the real Adler. But
yes. So this is a piece from a story called Jack of Demons. Psychiatry wasn't Julie's first choice of career. She wanted to be a ballerina or even a background dancer in the movies or maybe on stage. Job where she sat, that just wasn't her. And yet, instead of hoofing it in a little theater in the boonies, she was in the big city listening to people that she didn't particularly like, telling her things she'd just as soon not hear. Lately, Tuesdays had been the day that she most regretted. It wasn't just that it was her longest day, almost 6 full sessions, which is a lot of sitting, a lot of listening, but there was Cecile, who dreamed she was various talking animals and repeated the moment to moment of every one of her furry adventures in meticulous and tedious detail. There was Donna Biko, who had marriage on the brain. It was her only constant topic. This month she'd settled on a groom, Mars. Not the planet, which would have been odd enough, but the god it was named it for. Donna's sister Tabitha, who had the session immediately after her sister, talked about her fantasies in a way that left Julie extremely unsettled. The sexual ones were the least uncomfortable. The other 3 weren't nearly as bad, but each one represented Each one represented another 50 minutes of mind-numbing torture. Of course, her day didn't end when the patients left. All the administrivia of running the office still had to happen, plus there were papers to write and research to read. Some evenings, just reviewing her notes from the day kept her up half the night. The only upside to Tuesday was from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. in the afternoon. That stolen hour was like a mini vacation, and today that perk was about to vanish. Due to a DWI, Julie had been forced to do some favor trading with Judge Myers. He called in one of his markers, booking her last open Tuesday spot, not for himself. There was this man who appeared before him in some bizarre legal case. Worst of all was the fact that the new patient was a he. Julie normally only took on women. Her own therapist pushed her on the point several times, but Julie refused to examine her choice. And of course, the judge turned a deaf ear when she tried to wiggle out of it. That's why she was sitting in her 11 o'clock with Cecile, but thinking about Jack. All she knew was his name. No preliminary diagnosis, no notes from his day in court. And then, mercifully, the little timer on Julie's desk let out its gentle chiming tones. The session was over, and it was time for lunch. Julie offered bland, positive thoughts as she ushered Cecile to the door mid-sentence. "But I just got up to the part where the 3 men were beginning to groom my flowing mane," Cecile complained. "We can finish up talking about your time as a horse next time," Julie replied. "Lion," Cecile said petulantly. "I was a proud male lion." Julie gave a half-hearted apologetic shrug. As Cecile left, Marion, Julie's intern, walked in. "Bad news, good news, weird news," Marion said. "Well," Julie said impatiently. "Bad news, your new 2 o'clock, Jack Farino, that's confirmed. Good news, your 1 o'clock and your 4 o'clock have both canceled today." Marion said that, and then she hesitated before continuing. "Weird news. The potato closet is full." "I know you refused to tell me, but I'm asking, again, anyway. Why does the psychiatrist's office have a potato closet, and why are your patients handing me potatoes when they pay?" "Full, you say," Julie said, idly playing with her big, shiny silver bracelet. "So it's been 3 months since you started?" End of the week will be 3, yes, Marion said. Been here since the start of the fall semester. And you're committing to staying the full year. Then I'll tell you the 3 reasons for the potato payments, Julie said. Have a seat. Marion sat on the couch. It was a bit short for her excessively long legs. Julia thought the young woman was better suited to being a scarecrow than a student of psychiatry. Of course, the mop of unruly straw-colored hair did as much as her ungainly limbs to support that theory. Despite being 21, Marion looked like a teen who was first growing into her adult proportions. Paying a medical professional is a thing that people have to do. Even if it's just a copay, it's still a forced situation. When I tell a patient that I will discount a visit by $10 if they provide a potato at the time of payment, it gives them some agency in the process. It makes paying me a bonding point between us, she said. I think you're putting a lot of them on a potato, Marion said. Do you think people get all that secret meaning from your discount policy? I mean, seriously? Second, she said, ignoring the challenge in Marion's tone, I love potatoes. I could have them with every meal and frequently do. In fact, if you'll excuse me, I'm headed to lunch now, a long, leisurely lunch since my 1 o'clock canceled. Third reason, Marion prompted as she followed her boss out of the office. I like to see how long my interns will put up with it, Julie said. Lunch was good. That wasn't a compliment on the food. As she walked back to the office, Julie had already forgotten what she'd eaten. It was the pleasure of being in a room full of people who didn't expect her to listen, who would be offended if they caught her listening. It was the excitement of staring at those 2 gorgeous men sitting at the table across from her, hoping they'd stop staring into each other's eyes long enough to sneak a peek at her. It was the decadence of drawing out a meal in the middle of an endless workday. She held on to that feeling as best she could. Her mysterious and entirely male 2 o'clock would be waiting for her when she walked through the door into the waiting room. Despite her reservations, she headed inside. Julie Anson was many things, but a coward wasn't on the list. He was sitting there filling out the required forms. Julie didn't pause. She wanted their first words to be in the inner office with her desk between them. Male patients were not a comfort zone. Things had to go a certain way. Marion knew her boss well enough to know she couldn't show him in until Julie had time to settle in and strike a first meeting pose. As soon as the door closed behind him, he took a seat on his side of the mahogany desk and slumped down. His body language screamed of lack of confidence. She didn't care for screaming. Mr. Farino, she said, do you know why you're here? You already know, he said. It's a point in my saying it. I don't know, Julie said. I told the judge's office to send the papers after I met you. Why would anyone do that, he asked. So that you'd know 2 things, Julie replied. One is that you start with a blank slate. You have a chance to tell me how you see things without my having a bias. Secondly, you know I'll find out what's in the file. That requires you to balance your need to be understood with your need to be believed. Seeing how you handle those twin issues will tell me much more about you than the individual words you choose. So you're willing to hear my side of it, Jack said? This isn't going to be another person screaming at me? I'm sick to death of everyone yelling. Why'd you choke her? Well, constant accusations like the EMTs couldn't get her back. The doctors in the ER nearly didn't. Nobody ever wants to know why it's her fault. Julie did her best not to let the shock show. The judge had sent over a violent offender who freely admitted to nearly killing his girlfriend, wife, neighbor. She was alone in a room with a violent offender. How could the clerk agree to not send the papers knowing what Jack did? She knew that yelling for help would only make her more vulnerable. Besides, the only person who could come would be Marion. Jack might not be the most muscular man alive, but Marion was hardly more than a walking stick figure. No, she'd have to use the best weapons in her own arsenal, her ability to talk and her ability to understand the nature of his thoughts. She'd have to manage him till he left. Being a woman alone in a room with a man who had nearly choked another woman to death, that was a bad idea. She had to keep relating to her as a doctor instead. Her voice modulated something slightly deeper than her real tone. When she spoke, she amazed herself at how calm her voice sounded. Let's not talk about the event. Let's talk about how you 2 met, Julie offered. His entire demeanor changed. His face became softer. His expression was almost dreamy. As he looked upward, the way people do when they're trying to remember something clearly, she saw the face of a man who was infatuated, maybe even the face of a man in love. Normal people don't switch off their anger so quickly, so seamlessly. She was sure that was exactly that that he had done. There's this little park, little place my ma used to call them postage stamp parks, he began. People did community service there. That's why I was there. It's how we met. Julie suppressed a shudder. He wasn't just a raging, violent man. He also had a history of brushes with the law. If he was there for community service, that spoke of a lesser, nonviolent crime. His pathology could be a progression from the petty to the homicidal. She wasn't just thinking about her own safety now. Julie wondered what sort of person she'd be if she simply let him leave at the end of the hour. The unsuspecting public wouldn't have her knowledge or her tools. He might have escalated from near murder to something more complete. How could the judge have sent him over unescorted? "Are you listening?" Jack said calmly. "You wanted me to tell this." So there she was, eye-catching even in her orange jumpsuit, surrounded by others in the same clothes. Looked different on her. Warmer. Cooler. "Is that when you talked to her?" Julie asked. "Not that time," Jack said. "I did get my hands on the service schedule, so I could, you know, be there when she'd show up next time." She made a mental list. Violent, check. Escalating, check. Stalker, check. No guilt or discomfort admitting his actions, check. "So I talked to her the third time," Jack continued. "Her voice was nearly as nice as yours. Of course, I hadn't met you yet, so I was still impressed." Julie fought the urge to throw up. She was already on his radar. Her being a doctor didn't help create the emotional distance she wanted to generate for him. It made her a better target, another sort of escalation. She thought this. She saw him reach into his briefcase. She hadn't even noticed him bringing it in, which told her that she was dangerously distracted before his insanity began to express itself. A loud, jarring thud shook her. He'd pulled a potato and slammed it on her desk. She looked up from the spud and met his eyes. He seemed delighted by her reaction. This sort of man fed on fear, on the ability to evoke and control the reactions of others. For her part, she was moving beyond fear into certainty. Her life was in danger. "The potato's for the girl who takes the copay," Julie said automatically. Then it occurred to her. Why did he have a potato? Why would he give it to her? He must know about the policy. That meant he'd already checked her out. Obsessive behavior, stalking. She was already on his list before this. How far into his game were they? "Well, that's how we met," Jack said. "She told me to leave her alone. I was wasting my time, but I was persistent. We've been together 6 months now." 6 months, that spoke to a more gradual timeline, one where Julie might live to the end of the session. She took that little comfort that it presented to her and held it to her heart. "Tell me about your first date," she said. Anything to keep him talking, keep him reminiscing. If he got her attention this way, she reasoned, he might not be stepping things up. Normally, she prided herself on letting her patients find their own way, but today, in this moment, she was using everything she knew to manipulate him. This wasn't the time for ethical purity. This was the practicum, the realest of real tests of her skills. There was a knock at the door. She'd never been so grateful for an interruption. Julie slowly walked up, no sudden movements. "I need to see to that," she said. He let her walk to the door. She didn't dare look back. She didn't make eye contact. When she opened it, a very strong male hand pulled her into the waiting room. It belonged to one of the four police officers that rushed past her to confront her patient. Marion put her arm around Julie and walked her out of the office. The two women didn't stop until they were around the corner. There were three benches there. Two were in need of repair. They sat on the third. Julie looked around. This time she did throw up. The benches were there because this was a postage stamp park. She half expected to see orange jumpsuits, but the only other people there were an elderly couple walking a tiny brown dog. Marion pulled some white napkins from her pocket and helped Julie clean her face. They both looked at the mess at their feet. Neither was equipped emotionally or practically to clean it up. They walked to the other side of the little park and found another bench. "Police have him now," Marion said. "He described a park like this, maybe even this park," Julie said in a muted voice. "He might have been here, right near our office, for months. He knew about the potatoes. He's stalking me." Marion pulled out her phone and made a call. Squad car was there within minutes. As the intern and the officers spoke, Julie found out that Marion had insisted on walking Julie away. She'd insisted on saving her boss from being interviewed immediately. It was procedurally the wrong thing to do. Julie was extremely grateful. But now that the police had been called, however, it was time to answer their questions. Julie's not done with Jack, and Jack's not done with Julie. There's more to the story.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, and for the moment on Facebook Live in the WBAI radio group and in the Hour of the Wolf group. I don't think you have to be a member to be able to watch it there. Oh, and there is the one thing that is... If we are playing music, if we are playing a pre-recorded thing, it's not a person in studio live, you don't hear it on Facebook very well. you know, because the you're not hearing the radio, you're hearing the audio of my phone, the camera phone. So it's a very different kind of experience. So some of you may wish to switch to a radio or to going to WBAI.org, because this is, after all, well, a radio show first and, well, foremost. So this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Charles Barouch, which is B-A-R-O-U-C-H, bar ouch. And the name of that story again?
That is called Jack of Demons.
Jack of Demons. It's a very Zelazny-like title.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with the works of Roger Zelazny, one of my favorite writers.
Yes.
And
I'll be very atypical and say Road Marks is my favorite.
Ah, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the classic, of course, is Lord of Light.
Yep.
Which not enough people know. I don't know why. It won the Hugo, it won the Nebula. Mm-hmm. They almost made a movie out of it. They made a movie about making a movie out of it, which isn't about making a movie out of it, called Argo.
Yep.
Starring, was it Brad Pitt?
No, well, Clooney.
No, no.
No, it wasn't Clooney.
No, Clooney is not in it.
I am completely wrong then.
It was either Brad Pitt. It's not Matt Damon. It was Brad Pitt.
Okay.
No, no, no. Ben Affleck.
The other one.
The other one. Well, yeah. The other one. Yes, the other one. Matt Damon's writing partner.
Yeah.
So, yes, it was Ben Affleck. And did it win Best Film of the Year? I think it may have. Didn't deserve it, but it was a fun film. I really enjoyed it. And about the kind of thing that could never happen, like a conflict with Iran and holding the people in the embassy hostage. It is mostly a true story, except that the story happened to a CIA. Well, the part of the story they tell is about how this one person engineered the idea that they were going to film Lord of Light in Iran.
Yep.
And so they were scouting locations in the desert. And the movie had been rewritten. I mean, this novel had been written as the movie Argo, A-R-G-O.
Yeah.
And was really horrible, the screenplay. Zelazny has never really fared well on movie screenplays. The one, what was the name of the, Demolition Alley.
I didn't realize that was his.
That was his. Yep. And not knowing that was his is probably a good thing. Jan Michael Vincent was the lead in that film. And it is awful. It is something awful. And unbelievably, nobody else has ever made Zelazny movies. Now, there have been TV things, mostly done by George Martin, George R.R. Martin, who was the second showrunner of the second version out of four of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And he did The Last Defender of Camelot and another Zelazny script in there. And he was trying to present a TV series based on Doorways in the Sand.
Yep.
That he called Doorways.
Yep.
And was too close in pitching it to another series called Sliders. And Sliders had already sold. And it had just the vaguest similarity in premise that each week you'd be going to a different universe, a different world. And after that comes Stargate. And by that time, they said, no, we don't need that. And so George Martin decided, the hell with this. I'm writing Fire and Ice.
Yep.
And so, you know, 8 years of Game of Thrones later, you know, George has failed in obscurity. But George is a huge Zelazny fan and has always pushed his stuff forward. And George Martin, George R. Railroad Martin, as he used to be known when he lived about a block and a half from where we are, actually, Pacific Street and Bond, I think. He actually lives in Hoboken, but he stayed in that townhouse there. And use your influence while all the Game of Thrones spinoffs are going off. somebody should really create Lord of Light as a streaming series. Don't take the novel.
Yeah.
Take the premise.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do with all of these shows. That's what they do with Man in the High Castle. They're not filming Philip K. Dick. They simply took his universe and a couple of characters, one of whom they killed off, and then just put your own story into that universe. That's also what they were doing in season one of American Gods until the actual author, Neil Gaiman, came in, and somehow it didn't work after Neil Gaiman came in. Don't know why. I think it was just production problems.
There seems to be a lot of odd things going on with that show now.
There really are, and season three is falling apart, and it's not even been written yet. Yes. So
I have to give you my Game of Thrones confession.
Okay.
I've seen the first three episodes, and I saw the last episode.
I've seen the first eight episodes, and I have not seen the last episode.
I saw the last episode at a Game of Thrones watch party.
Ah.
And I got invited to this thing, and while I was there, and they're all chatting about it, and somebody asked me my opinion, and I said, I've actually only seen the first three episodes. And they're like, why are you here? I said, I like you people, and you're serving drinks and snacks. So
yes, exactly.
So we watched the episode, and at the end, Harry, who is the host, looks at me and says, so what did you think? I said, actually, it makes a wonderful first episode. Because they're tying up all these plot lines, and if I came into the show as I did, not really knowing all this stuff, I'm looking and going, wow, I wish I knew the backstory of that. I wish I knew why that person said that. I wish I knew why that person winced there. It was a great first episode, and maybe they should have done that.
And even then, it was a little gory.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is why I didn't watch it. It was there was some big courtyard battle in episode 8, and they kept going back to this one effect of this person whose neck had been sliced open, and they kept going to the arterial spouting of blood. And I'm very good with gory movies. I know when to close my eyes or examine a painting across the room instead of watching and listening for the music cues and the sound effects to know when to look back. But the producers of the show were smarter. They knew that the people who were going to turn away were looking back at a certain moment. And then even though the focus had left the courtyard, somebody mentioned the battle, and they go back to show the arterial spouting. And you cannot wash your eyeballs enough to get that out of your head. And X many years later, I still see that. And that's not entertainment to me. That's...
If I knew horror was so triggering, I would have read from a different story for you.
Oh, no. It's not a question of horror. It's a question of gore.
Yes.
It's what I call gornography.
Yes.
Like, I have no problem watching The Haunting or any Shirley Jackson. Although The Haunting of Hill House, the Netflix version, got a little borderline there.
I will tell you, I got through four episodes then. I was like, I'm not sure why I'm watching this. And then they finally got to the twist. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm watching this. And I really, really enjoyed it.
No, I understand that the writing is excellent. But there's the bent neck lady.
Yes.
Which is pretty,
It was phenomenal the way it was handled. It was a good reveal, to use your term that you picked up earlier.
Yes.
Yeah.
Coinage that I stole from Michael Bishop that he probably got elsewhere, but I got it from him, so good enough. But
you know the term Dunning-Kruger, I assume.
Yes.
So Dunning-Kruger is the syndrome where people who spent 5 minutes on the internet figure the topic's only 7 minutes long and therefore they're an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And on the flip side, people who really know a subject so deeply immersed they understand how much bigger the subject is, they feel less authority.
Right.
So because we're talking horror, I actually have a short story I wrote called Dunning-Kruger, a Debt Collector on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe I should have read from that.
Yeah.
Yes.
That sounds like a fun one. Well, you'll come back. You can do it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get you and Gordon together or something like that. That would be a fun show.
It would be a lot of fun.
Gordon Lunsner. But at any rate, I have a problem with what I call gornography. Mm-hmm. Which is which I stole. There was an article years ago, like 10 years ago, from the Manchester Guardian that mentioned the term gornography. And I've co-opted it. Mm-hmm. And nobody else has ever heard of it. but I think it makes perfect sense. It's not the violence. It's not that it's gore for gore's sake.
Yep.
Doesn't advance the story. It's simply put there to, like, the word titillate is wrong to...
I know what you mean. There's a comedian, and I wish I could remember his name so I could properly attribute. But he says that, you know, things like that and jump scares. He says, it's like if I ran out into the audience and tickled you and said, you laughed, I'm a good comedian.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not in service of the plot. It's not in service of the story. It doesn't bring you to that point in some controlled way.
Yeah.
And when you're mentioning Hill House has a lot of that where the horror comes from the fact that you're paying attention to the story.
Yeah, but
it, your connectedness to what's going on.
But the movie, The Haunting,
mm-hmm.
I assume you're familiar with it.
Yes.
Remains one of the best horror movies ever made. It has no gore. It has no violence. You do not see the supernatural in it. Simply certain people end up behaving certain ways. And
well,
one
if you're going to do that, you've seen Pontypool, I assume.
Say again?
Pontypool?
Pontypool.
Stephen McHattie?
Run that by me.
It is actually the perfect movie for you to watch because a large portion takes place in a radio station.
Ah, I don't know it. And I'm sorry, we're just losing Facebook now. Because, you see, I always... It's gone.
Yeah.
It's already gone. And I know why.
We didn't plug in the phone, did we?
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. It ran out of battery. And with 15 minutes to go, it would take too long just to recharge the phone to the point that it would come back up. So hopefully the people that were watching on Facebook are also listening to the radio.
Yep.
And so mote it be. But at any rate, you were talking off the air about how many different genres you are trying to write in. And I'm wondering what sparks that? What is driving you? And which is another way of saying, where do you crazy writers get those stupid ideas? Some of those wonderful ideas.
During the reading, I talked about my process.
And the answer, by the way, is Schenectady. But oh, that really is the answer.
Yeah. During the reading that we did in December for Across the Universe, I gave my explanation of my process. I write from a deep emotional place. That place is called anger and frustration.
Mm-hmm.
I watch a TV show, and these two guys dressed up as knights walk down the road past this magnificent ruin, and they keep walking. And I'm like, no, the ruin. That was really interesting. Go back over there. And when they continue walking, I write a story about the ruins.
Right.
I will never run out of material because I will never run out of people who I feel have missed opportunities.
Yeah.
I will never miss the opportunity to find their missed opportunities.
Well, you know who wrote of that and that syndrome? Le Guin.
Yes.
Le Guin, what is the name of the character? There is a Virginia Woolf book. Mrs. Dalloway, does that sound right? I'm not
possible.
As familiar with Virginia Woolf as I should be.
I'm still trying to figure out how we jump from Le Guin to Woolf, but we'll get there.
Because this is an essay by Le Guin about Virginia Woolf.
Ah, okay.
Okay. And the premise is why Mrs. Dalloway will never be in science fiction.
Okay.
And the thing is that there is a character, our lead character, is on a train sharing the car, as of course mm-hmm. you must, and this woman comes on and bursts into tears. And we don't know why. She takes out a book, she reads it a little, she bursts into further tears. And we're wondering even more why. And she gets off the train. And we never hear from her again, and we never know what that story was about. And what happens is stuff continues on the train, but Wolf's intention was that your mind should follow that woman who got off the train.
Yeah.
And Le Guin was saying, and this is the 70s.
Yep.
So we have to allow for time. Le Guin's claim premise is that you don't get characters like that in science fiction. It was not subtle enough.
Yep.
It was, like in Star Wars, you don't get subsidiary characters that go away and leave you off. And if you do, there's going to be a whole series of books about them that are sold as ancillary stuff.
Right.
But that is the premise. That is what Virginia Woolf was trying to do in that novel. And that is what Le Guin was writing about in science fiction. So you see, it actually does all put together.
See, I actually talk about that when I teach. I teach classes once a year. This is a fun thing that I do. I go to a anime convention called Otakon. And I wanted to go there because both of my daughters were there. And I wanted to have some time with my kids.
And how old
are
they?
34 and 38.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
I was waiting for 4 and 8.
No. So Laura and Danny both go to this convention. And I wanted to go there. And I don't know how to attend things anymore. So I actually found a way to work the convention. I told them I would I'd teach a writing class. And I've been doing it for 7 years now, and it's huge fun. But one of the things that I talk about is that whole idea of those kind of characters.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite example, of course, is Tom Stoppard. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are not dead.
Are dead,
I'm sorry. Which is talking about these two characters who are very minor in Hamlet. They show up in a scene, they get killed off stage, and he tells the story from their arc.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a friend of mine, Jen Thorson, I just picked up a book of hers, where she does Alice in Wonderland from the viewpoint of Marianne, the person the White Rabbit's calling for when he runs into Alice, who we never see in the story at all. And she actually generated Marianne, who's the carpenter's daughter, from The Walrus and the Carpenter, and carried her through the story from her perspective as to what's going on in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
And those kind of things make my heart happy. It's wonderful to me when you can write a world that's got things bigger than that. I actually did that with Adjacent Fields. I have two characters in there that are from a story that I wrote when I was 12 years old, and I felt very grown up because I had a character who was 14 to 16 years old in the story. I was writing an older character that way.
Okay.
Yeah, writing the adults wasn't a big deal, but I was writing an older teenager. And I actually worked two of those characters in, and they make passing reference to things nobody will ever read because that story will never come out. But I had their backstory. They were having an experience that happened to transit through this story.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the co-authoring things I'm doing a 6-book series with John Frater and Ian Harrick. I'm writing the first and last book. John is writing the second and fifth book, and Ian's writing the pivot. He's writing the third and fourth book. And the characters are intersecting with each other. And one of my favorite moments is there's this one character who's a constant cheerleader for my main character. And the first thing John did with the scene that he connected to her in is she turns to John's character and says, "Do you know how exhausting it is to constantly be supporting this woman?" And it was like, I didn't write her that way, but you know what? That's how I should have written her. That's a great moment where you see her when the main character is finally not in the room. And so, yes, I love exactly what you're talking about there. I love that concept of characters who are bigger than the story you're listening to at the moment that prove the world is bigger and more interesting. And no, you don't always get the end of the story. You don't get to get on that airplane 12 years later and find out why Carl hired you. A lot of times the story's open.
Yeah.
And that fascinates me.
I found out why my phone ran out. I didn't bring a plug with me.
You didn't?
No, I must have left it at home, and it's annoying me beyond all hell. Not just we lost the Facebook, but I had a wonderful quote from what I call RNG, that you call Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are alternately not dead or dead. And it's one I've tried to memorize it. It's only about 75 words.
Yep.
But
well, you've spoken more than 75 words. I know that's within your range.
Well, it's a quote from Rosencrantz. I saw that play on my 13th birthday.
Oh, very nice.
And in its first Broadway run. And it's a very meaningful play for me. And if anybody gets to see the National Theater production that was filmed starring Daniel Radcliffe as, well, either Rosencrantz or Guildenstern. It was perfectly done. Tom Stoppard directed his own version with Gary Oldman and, a Chicago-based actor, great actor, Gary Sinise. No. And it's not very good. Stoppard isn't a director.
Yep.
He writes decent screenplays, not great screenplays.
Yeah.
Screenplays are not his greatest forte, although he's written many of them, and he's known as a very good doctor for screenplays. He did the original version of his Dark Materials before the movie got made. His script for episode one was 7.5 hours long. They thought that was a bit excessive, but it isn't. Because now that it's an HBO series, which, by the way, does let the novel down in a number of ways, that's 8 hours long.
Yep.
Stoppard's was shorter. for the record. But he's written better plays like Arcadia, but Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is still, I think, his masterpiece. Sadly, it's also his first play, so I guess Arcadia is the masterpiece, but RNG is the entry level. It's Samuel Beckett for the classicists.
No, I had the great good luck of stinking when I started writing and building myself up from there. So I've had an upward arc, but I've started from a place that gave me nothing but upward arc as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Writing is a muscle.
Yeah.
The exercise.
It is very difficult talking to certain writers who I will not name when they have written a work when they're not that far into their career. And it is the best thing they have ever written and ever will write.
Yes.
Just because what they have done is so brilliant that you can't surpass it. And that's the one question I feel I can never ask a writer is, like, how do you feel after you wrote Masterpiece?
Yep.
You know, and it's now 30 years later, and you know you're not going to write Masterpiece 2, and if you do, it won't be any good. So it's a tough question, but it's I got a 3-minute interview once with Stoppard when Arcadia came to Lincoln Center. But if I had the opportunity to really have a bona fide interview with him, I think I would not be shy about asking him about revisiting.
He might be at a point where he could take that question.
Oh, I think so.
Because
he still brings it to BBC Radio. He still does talk about it. And I wouldn't be surprised to find that it might be his favorite play. Not his best.
Yep.
Just favorite.
Yep.
Although he did a whole lot of fun plays. I'm a huge Stoppard fan, you see.
Yep.
And that play lies at the center of it. But, and I have that quote on my phone, and it's out of power, and I didn't bring the plug for charging it. I have the battery. I don't have the plug.
Yep.
Damn it. And probably because I took it out of the bag to make sure it was working. And
I've done that.
I did that this evening, and I realize now I probably never put it back in the bag. It's not in the bag, as it were. But if people remember this speech, a man, I will paraphrase, which I hate to do when it comes to Stoppard.
Yeah.
A man is on a road and he spies a unicorn crossing the street, crossing the road. This in of itself is startling, but not necessarily the totality of the experience. Now there's another person with him who witnesses the same thing. And this is the highest point that it can ever reach because he has affirmation that it is real. But you add a third person and a fourth person, and it diminishes the more people that see the unicorn until a crowd gathers and says, "Oh, look, there's a horse with an arrow in its forehead. Somebody must have mistaken it."
Yep.
For something else. You see, I can't paraphrase it properly. But the philosophy behind that little monologue, which is so typical of Stoppard, and is so typical of they're not only the characters from Hamlet that don't matter. They have their own little bits
yep.
that take you into these wonderful worlds, which is where the whole... Because in case people think that it's about Shakespeare, no, it's about Samuel Beckett.
Yeah.
It's about Waiting for Godot.
Which a lot of people have a lot of mixed feelings about.
Well, if they're not into Beckett, and not everybody is...
Yeah.
Or if they really aren't Beckett, the way that Simon Lokely, the late Simon Lokely, whose show used to follow mine when I was on Saturday mornings, his only problem with it is that Beckett is God.
Yeah.
And to be revered. But he liked Stoppard as well.
Yeah.
And he recognized that Stoppard was one of the few playwrights who was having dialogue with Beckett the same way that Beckett was having dialogue with James Joyce.
Yeah.
That's not a bad dialogue to have.
No, it's not. It's a good room.
Yeah, it is. It is. And if people can't handle, you know, Beckett can be weird. Stoppard can be pretty weird, depending on the play.
Mm-hmm.
Or the movie.
Yep.
He's written some pretty interesting movies, including one for Spielberg based on the life of J.G. Ballard, Empire of the Sun.
Yep.
By Tom Stoppard. Well... Ballard wrote a fictional autobiography.
Yeah.
You know, the whole class of that. Fictional autobiographies, I love it.
Yep.
And Stoppard made it even more fictional, but even more about Ballard
yep.
at the same time. Interesting yep. movie. And, oh, my God. Hey, Lester.
Yeah.
I'm in your time slot again.
No, you just keep cruising.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
You got another 2 minutes?
No, I don't. My theme music is 3.5 minutes long. So I have another 2 minutes, but I have to play something for 3.5.
Right, but you do have another 2 minutes.
It doesn't work that way.
To quote Futurama, you are correct. You're technically correct, which is the best kind of correct.
You take 5 minutes. I got to go. Okay.
Enjoy yourself. Yeah. Or to quote Futurama, good news, everybody.
Yeah.
Lister's going to be away for 5 minutes. So let us sum up wish you a good morning. And
thank you.
Again, you are Charles Baruch, Barouch. People will find your work how?
They will go to hdwp.com, which stands for Humpty Dumpty Was Pushed. You'll never forget that.
Oh, okay. That,
yes, hdwp.com/r/CDB, which are my initials.
Oh, clever. Okay.
And CDB was also the name of a children's book by Steig from a...
William Steig.
Yeah, William Steig from...
Not everybody knows,
yes.
You know.
From Windmill Press,
but
where my
know,
sister well, used to work.
Ah, really?
Yes.
Yeah, and people who don't know the name William Steig because they didn't read The New Yorker, watch
yep.
his cartoon,
yep.
look at his cartoons or anything,
but,
they know one work of
yep.
his and one work only. They didn't know he wrote it.
Yeah.
Shrek.
Yep. But he wrote CDB, which is all written in that style.
Shrek.
UCDB, ICDB, SMNOB, SMR.
Yeah. No, Shrek is a personal favorite, but I'm not talking about the movie.
Yes. I won't tell Mike Myers that you said that.
Actually, don't care much about Mike Myers. No, he may be a lovely guy. I'm
yeah.
just not a fan of his cinema. There yeah. are people who I have met who I do not care for their cinema at all, and they are wonderful people.
Yeah.
And then it goes the other way around.
The one thing I loved was he did an interview where he was talking about Austin Powers, which I did not enjoy. And his comment was, I literally wrote a movie that would be funny to four people hung out in my basement.
Yeah.
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 And
that was all he was trying to do.
Yes. Well, one thing you can say in favor of Austin Powers, it was better than Goldmember.
That is true.
Yeah. That's,
and I know that just from seeing the commercials.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Thank you, Charles, for being here. We will do this again. In the meantime,
appreciate
everybody
that.
Listening, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Please be good to each other now more than ever as the world collides in so many ways. So don't you be on that path. And I'll be back next week, 1, 2, 3. That's to say from 1 until 3 a.m., Wednesday night, Thursday morning, with, well, some agenda. I'll probably figure it out about 3 minutes before broadcast. See you then. Hear you then. Take care. Good morning. Yeah, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, coming your way in just a few moments. Are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. Lister is out of the bathroom and almost naked, which means that his radio show, nice abs, his radio show is going to be coming this way as soon as he can slip. As soon as he gets his hugs and can slip a CD when nobody's looking. Yeah. Okay. So which pot comes up there? Oh, here we are. Is that CD1? Yes, that's CD1. Don't go there. Don't go there. It's, you know, one of the seven words. Okay, try CD2. Okay. Ooh.
You got mad at you.
Oh, hello.
Let's turn it on.
Yeah. Ah, yeah. You know what?
I said, take your trick.
To quote the Far Sign Theater, it heard the word power and it responded just like we do. So.
I told you I don't use technology.
Yes.
Not ready for prime time.
Okay, so that's CD1, is that? Okay, CD1, okay.
I'm with the left.
Oh, no,
when I leave,
there.
You can feel my
death. You're on the air,
last words on my lips. I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red, white, and blue will spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution.
know that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others. Take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Cause my hurt is internal, the American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Arizona. Yeah. We have one hell of a show for you this morning until 5 o'clock. Burn, baby, burn style.
Amplify, Lord. Build it up higher, equal. and then bending the rules we apprehend, and now we send them away. Shout out to the rhythm, don't keep sleeping. Hear the new song, DJ, give it another play. Ready now, we prepare for action. New version will catch and you can't escape. So feed the spirit chanting, give thanks, put your hands up and dance, because dancing is great. Explode.